Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Sometimes it seems there are campaign issues in an election year, and there are real issues, and the real issues don't always get an airing. In the weeks and months ahead, we're going to try. Health care is huge on the campaign trail, but health care costs, the elephant in the waiting room, sometimes barely get a mention. Real issue, especially when those costs are and have been exploding. Real issue. This hour On Point, the bottom line in the health care debate, the unhealthy cost of American health care. Two big thinkers with us today from Annapolis, Maryland. Shannon Brownlee joins us, author of Overtreated, Why Too Much Medicine is Making Us Sicker and Poorer. The New York Times' David Leonhardt calls it the best economics book of 2007. She's a longtime health and medical journalist and a senior fellow at the New America Foundation. Shannon Brownlee, thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, I'm pleased to be there, here.
Everywhere. And with me in the studio, Regina Herzlinger, professor at Harvard Business School. The Economist magazine calls her America's leading advocate of market-driven health care reform. Money magazine calls her the godmother of consumer-driven health care. She's advised both Hillary Clinton and John McCain on their health care plans and continues to informally advise McCain. Her new book is Who Killed Healthcare? Regina Herzlinger, thank you very much for being here as well.
How nice to be here.
It's wonderful to have you both. All right. Here's the question. Shannon, I'll put it to you first. The suggestion in everything I read from you is that we cannot fix healthcare, whatever that is going to mean, without fixing healthcare costs. Why not?
Well, I'll quote Peter Orszag, the head of the Congressional Budget Office here, who says that the fiscal health of the nation depends on reining in health care costs. That's the sort of big reason. But the other reason is that health care costs and bad quality go hand in hand, and we have extraordinarily poor quality health care. And if we want to improve that quality, we're going to have to address both quality and the things that drive costs.
I thought we had the world's best health care.
Well, we don't. We actually have remarkably bad health care, especially considering how much we pay. And there are arguments about the sort of international statistics that people can make. They're sort of inside baseball arguments. But the fact is that the quality of our care is really not very good. And if you do international comparisons on the basis of individual diseases, like how do we do at keeping people from dying from their heart attacks, we don't do very well there either.
Cite some statistics or something here. This is so at odds with the general public perception of the quality of American health care. I think we need some meat on the bones of that assertion.
Well, the World Health Organization recently ranked the healthcare systems of more than 100 countries, and we didn't come in near the top. We came in 37th. That's one statistic that you can look at. You can also look at statistics like infant mortality and longevity at birth. We don't come in very well, and we don't even come in very well at longevity at age 60, because at age 65, everybody's basically insured. And so the lack of insurance can't be blamed for our poor statistics and our poor life expectancy for the elderly.
Regina Herzlinger, we heard Peter Orszag quoted there saying the fiscal health of the nation depends on fixing this. Now, the nation's fiscal front bears some pretty big burdens and trundles along. I mean, that suggests that health care costs are somehow a threat to our basic, I don't know, solvency.
Absolutely. They're a threat to one big component of the economy, and that is the business community. The United States is alone among major countries in having the business community pay for so much of health care. And our health care costs, of course, at 17% of GDP, dwarf those of other countries, developed countries, that spend from 10 to 12% of GDP. And our employers pay for a much larger fraction of those huge costs.
So when GM is trying to put 72,000 people off their payroll this week, look at health care costs, you say?
Absolutely. GM says it costs it $1,500 per car for health care. Toyota, $100. Those numbers are likely apocryphal political numbers. Let's say the real numbers are $1,300 and $300. Can General Motors engineer $1,000 worth of costs out of its cars to compete with Toyota just because of our health care? Not a chance in hell that's going to be happening. Furthermore, because most people get their health insurance from their employers, and the employers who offer health insurance tend to be big companies, people stay in jobs in big, boring, bureaucratic companies rather than going to work for the entrepreneurial companies that are the lifeblood of the U.S. economy.
And ought to be the future.
Absolutely. Big problem. Absolutely.
Shannon Brownlee, I'm looking here.
Just to follow up on
that,
there's a real opportunity cost here. When you put so much money into health care, and you're putting it into what's fundamentally a very, very inefficient industry, it's not producing what you want, which is health, and it's doing it at a very high cost. There's a real opportunity cost there in terms of what people could be doing with that money, like starting new entrepreneurial businesses.
Why isn't all this money buying us better health? I'm looking here at a story from last month saying that in 2006, the most recent figures, national health spending soared above $2 trillion, an average of $7,000 a person. That's double what it was a decade earlier. Shannon, why doesn't that buy us gleaming, glistening, you know, Garden of Eden health?
Well, I see two reasons. Number one, because an enormous amount of the care that's delivered is actually doing nothing for people's health. It's over-treatment, it's unnecessary care. And number two, a great deal of the care that's delivered is very, very poorly coordinated. In other words, if you have a chronic disease, and this is where the bulk of our costs go, is into people who have chronic diseases like heart failure, like cancer, like diabetes. If you have a chronic disease, you are being hospitalized repeatedly, often, and you are seeing multiple physicians. And there is remarkably little coordination between those among those physicians. It's like, you know, everybody's playing football, but they're all running different plays on the field at the same time.
Let's pick those up one at a time. Over-treatment. Nobody wants extra treatment to be poked or prodded more than necessary. It's not fun. I can speak to that. Why do we have over-treatment when I would think, by and large, patients aren't, you know, lining up for to be going to the knife or anything else that they don't have to be?
I think there are several reasons for it. One of the reasons that's cited most often by physicians in particular is malpractice worries, that physicians are worried that they'll be sued if they don't give patients every single test possible, every single procedure that anybody might think of. And I think that's certainly a piece of it. But an enormous part of the overtreatment comes because physicians and hospitals are paid to do more, not to do better. They have every financial incentive to give people more and more care rather than to give them care that's truly effective.
Every procedure they prescribe means ka-ching something in their bank.
Right. This is the fee-for-service payment system. But the other thing that is driving this unnecessary care is that the health care sector is actually overbuilt in many parts of the country. So it's that the supply of resources ends up driving what happens to you rather than what you actually need to have done to improve your health.
Regina, you're very market-oriented when it comes to solutions, responses to this, and we'll look at that. But here's a case where fee-for-service, that sounds like the market to me, and Shannon says it's a big reason that our healthcare costs are over the moon.
First of all, McKinsey, that great consulting firm, I don't do any consulting, I'm no shill for McKinsey, but McKinsey attacked the question of why U.S. healthcare costs are so high. And the key component, according to them, when comparing the U.S. to countries of similar wealth, is that we spend $400 billion of unnecessary funds on hospitals. Our hospitals are vastly inefficient. Now, are people overtreated? I would say, although Shannon's great book has that title, people are more mistreated, especially those with chronic diseases. Now, we all know Pareto's Law, 80-20. 20% of the beer drinkers drink 80% of the beer. 20% of the sick account for 80% of the costs. They have very complex diseases, And typically, many of the preventive measures they need, many of the diagnostic tests that would tell the physicians whether they're appropriately treated or not, they don't get them. And the reason is the lack of integration in our healthcare system. So these patients are passed from one provider to the next, and that baton is often missed.
That doesn't make sense to me. In the information era, computers all over every doctor's office and hospital. We know, the Internet, every child is out there wired up to every other child in the universe, it seems. Why should information be a problem in 2008?
Great question. So our healthcare system is incredibly fragmented. You would think with 20% of the people accounting for 80% of the cost that you could find an AIDS center, a diabetes center, a cancer center, stage 4 breast cancer. You can't find them. The system has doctors, hospitals, nursing homes, labs, radiology facilities. It's not organized according to the patient's needs. It's organized in a way that's good for the providers, and they're not integrated, to answer your question. Mm.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at one of the real issues beneath the 08 campaign this hour, the cost of American healthcare. It is enormous. Some say out of control. There's no way to fix the system, we're told, without addressing what it all costs. Shannon Brownlee joins us, healthcare journalist. Her new book is Overtreated, Why Too Much Medicine is Making Us Sicker and Poorer. New York Times called it the best economics book of 2007. Regina Herzlinger is with us as well, professor at the Harvard Business School. Her most recent book is Who Killed Healthcare? That doesn't sound like the path to health. 800-423-TALK. Karen is calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Karen, you're on the air.
Hello, how are you?
Very well.
I wanted to thank the woman who wrote Overtreated. Every single thing she says is true. We just experienced it within the last 3 months regarding my 87-year-old mother-in-law. She has many health problems. And immediately following an emotional loss, she had a visit from a daughter who lives very far away.
Mm-hmm.
And when the daughter left, obviously my mother-in-law went into a decline. She may never see her daughter again.
So how did the overtreatment come in, Karen?
Well, immediately after this, she complained of an ongoing physical problem. She has a problem with gastric esophageal reflux.
Okay.
Everybody knows
yep.
what that is.
Yep.
And the doctor, rather than treating the underlying depression and anxiety and sadness, she had a little bit of blood in her vomit, and the doctor, even though I pleaded, please don't do this, the doctor, rather than treating it with medication and sympathy and support, hospitalized an 87-year-old woman, and everybody knows what happens. She went downhill, and it has taken probably $30,000 to $40,000 in insurance costs, both Medicare and private insurance, 3 weeks of hospitalization, many weeks of rehab.
What do you think she should have had instead, Karen?
Sympathy, listening, emotional support, and watchful care. Changing the medication. GERD, as it's known, is not an unusual problem. People can treat it with medication. Supportive and watchful medication. If there was something wrong there, act more aggressively. But she was in the hospital and had colonoscopies and endoscopies, and of course, nothing was found.
Up one side and down the other, we can hear the kind of justifications that could have been made, I can well imagine, but you're watching and saying what she really needed was sympathy. Shannon Brownlee, what do you say to the story? The doctor would say, well, she's got, you know, there's blood here and a reflux problem, and we've got to get in here and do something. Or Regina, right here with me.
Well, what we need is to change the payment system. Rather than paying by procedures so that the providers are financially motivated to do more, we should have a bundle of payment for GERD, which is the disease that what a sad story.
This is gastric reflex problem.
Gastric esophageal reflex disease that your poor mother-in-law had. And if there were a flat payment for GERD victims, the providers would have every incentive to figure out what's the best thing to do, rather than saying, well, gee, I get paid more for hospitalizing her, I'm going to hospitalize her.
Do you think it's as crude and self-interested as that?
No, I do not. I believe that our providers are very well motivated, by and large, professionals who want to do the right thing. But the way they're paid, they get screwed if they do the right thing. If they make people healthy under our current payment system, they lose money. No good deed goes unpunished in healthcare.
Shannon, what do you hear in Karen's story, the story of her mother-in-law?
Karen, thanks so much for sharing your story and for your kind words about my book. I agree with Regina that bundling payments is one way that we could start getting a grip on this.
And what do you mean by that again?
It means that you basically have a condition and that the payer gives the provider, the hospital or the physician or the two of them together, which I think is ultimately the best way to do it, a set fee for caring for this kind of condition. And the problem right now is that when there is infinite supply of hospital beds or a large supply of hospital beds, and the physician has this sick patient and says, well, the bed is available and, you know, more care is, physicians themselves often think more care is better, they hospitalize the patient, and once the patient is hospitalized, it's almost as if it, you know, the machine starts running. This whole, they get on a train and the train keeps moving. So more testing happens, more invasive testing happens. So there are sort of two things going on here. One is that there's a mindset going on, and I agree that our providers really are, for the most part, very well-meaning and really want to do the best thing that they can. But there's a mindset that says, you know, hospitalize a patient, more intensive care is better. And the other thing that gets forgotten is we need to think about what the elderly really need. And we forget that often what they really, their greatest needs are spiritual. Their greatest needs are how to deal with mortality.
Sympathy, as our caller Karen says. Another word for that.
Caring for people.
Mm-hmm.
And instead, what we do is we provide invasive procedures.
Let's get a perspective from Mason City, Iowa, and Walt. Hi, Walt. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a medical oncologist. I'm one of these chronic disease treaters that have been in this for about 28 years. And I just have a couple of comments. First of all, a little bit of a background. I'm really a socialist. I get paid a straight salary. It does not vary from year to year. It makes no difference whether I treat some or not. It's just a flat, straight salary.
So you work for an HMO then, Dr. Walt?
I am. It's not an HMO, but I'm employed by a hospital cancer center.
And you're a socialist politically, or you mean you're just in an economic system that feels socialist to you?
Even more defined than that, medically I'm a socialist.
Okay.
In the sense that I don't think the current fee-for-system works terribly well, so in that way I agree. But I guess my comment is I get the same pressures for healthcare costs as people who have actual incentives.
Mm-hmm.
The pressures come actually from patients themselves. And, you know, in the comments about people wanting, needing empathy and not requiring treatments, I couldn't agree more. I think I spend more time trying to talk some of the elderly out of treatments rather than into them. But I can't tell you how many times I am amazed that I'll sit across the desk from a patient of mine and say, there's this horrible drug. It's going to cost $5,000 a month.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to make you sick. It may extend your life by 3 months. And if I were you, I wouldn't do it.
And they say?
And they look at you and say, we want it. Or their family, who, you know, a lot of times comes in from California, is pushing them to do it.
Okay, and this is great. The plot thickens, and it's hard for you to say no. Even though you're not fee for service, you're on a flat salary.
It's impossible for me to say no, because when I am across the desk from my patient, My priority at that point is that patient. It's not the health care of the system.
Walt, you really help us blow it open here, and I want to ride that right straight on because it goes to the kind of solutions that we're hearing from both of my guests today. Regina, you look to the market, and it's sophisticated, but nevertheless, to give consumers choices to solve this problem. Walt's case would suggest maybe that's not a solution. If consumers are going to go for something that, you know, painful, expensive, only gets you 3 months and drives costs through the roof. Shannon, you say we need to find standardized treatments right across the country that everybody agrees on, and sort of, as I read you, kind of cap treatment at that. But there's the consumer sitting across the table or at the ballot box saying, I don't want anything that sounds like a lid on what I can receive. Shannon, first to you. What do you say?
Well, there are two things going on here. And I, as a member of the media, I need to sort of say mea culpa here. Part of the reason that patients often want everything and often say, you know, do everything for grandma that you possibly can, and doing anything less than everything is sort of seen as tantamount to killing the
crime,
patient.
Yeah.
The media has had a lot to do with this, and we have in many ways oversold everything that's new in medicine. And we have given the American public this idea that medicine can do more than it really can often. Number two, I think that I don't advocate that we sort of, you know, see what works and then cap what we're going to pay for. I think that Regina and I are in agreement in many ways that when it comes to things like elective knee surgery, for example, or deciding you want to take a very, very aggressive chemotherapy drug.
Okay.
If there's evidence that this is sort of marginally effective, I think that it's appropriate to ask patients to pay a larger share of the freight.
Isn't that capping in effect? I mean, when you talk about a larger share of healthcare costs, most people can't pull that out of their pocket.
Well, I think that if it's proven to be highly effective, if we have, say, a drug that is proven to be very, very effective, and we should just simply say it's free. You can get this drug. But if you have something like, for example, spine surgery, which is not very well proven in terms of its ability to relieve pain in many, many cases.
And by the way, I'm looking at statistics here saying we spent $86 billion on spine treatments in 2005,
yeah.
65% up from just 1997 after adjusting for inflation, and the proportion of Americans with impaired function because of spine problems actually increased during that period, even controlling for aging. So anyway,
yeah, somehow we're not doing the right thing in terms of spinal pain. So spine surgery has not been shown to be terribly effective in many, many cases. And so what we need to do is inform patients as fully and clearly as possible about what the possible benefits are, what the possible risks are, and then say this is really not very well-proven treatment. And if you still want to go ahead with it, you have to carry some of the burden of the cost.
It's depending on what that is, it could easily be described on the campaign trail as a cap or something like it. But Regina, let me turn to you. Our doctor in Mason City, Iowa, says, you know, the consumer who you're counting on, you're saying give them more information, make the system more transparent, give them kind of like George Bush suggested at some point, I think, a kind of a healthcare account that they can spend from and let them decide where to put their money. If they're going to reach for everything and anything under the sun, does the market really contain costs?
One of the reasons that Dr. Walt is in this terrible dilemma is that the patients, or more likely in this case, their guilt-laden family members, think that this is free, doesn't cost them anything, and they have no knowledge of the marginal costs. When people are more involved with the costs of their medical care, something very surprising happens, and that is they take better care of themselves. And when McKinsey again said, why are you taking better care of yourself now that you have to pay more yourself? People say, gee, it's my money. So in his case, I could imagine a market-based solution. One insurance policy says, for example, I flatline, you don't do anything, you pull the plug. Another insurance policy says, I flatline, you bring on the whole armada to make me come alive again. Well, the second insurance policy is clearly going to cost much more than the first one. And in that way, the market will speak people who are willing to pay that much more for these marginal efforts, as Shannon describes them. Good for them. It's their choice.
Shannon Bradley, let's see. I'm trying to keep track of these paths of solution here. You're both saying put some financial incentive or put the cost onto the consumer at some level, but yet you've got pretty different paths that you're proposing. Shannon?
Well, I think that we need to do this in multiple ways, and I think that giving patients more skin in the game, as it's been called, in cases where they're looking at elective procedures, elective treatments, or that are marginally effective or don't have any evidence for efficacy. I think that's a very useful way to do one piece of it. But I also think that we need to start putting pressure on hospitals in terms of the way they have invested in resources. And the kinds of resources that hospitals invest in are things like CT scanners, MRI machines, specialists, the physicians that they have contracts with, or that they hire, the number of beds they have, et cetera, et cetera. And
who's going to do that? Insurance companies, the federal government?
I think Medicare has to be the one that does that. I don't think that the private insurance market is going to be able to be coordinated enough to be able to do it, but it will follow what Medicare does.
Is that going to fly politically in this country? You know, the politicians will say, they're taking CT scanners out of your hospital, they're turning us back into a third world, blah, blah.
Well, they can say that, but I think that the evidence is going to be pretty clear as we go forward that there are these places in the country where we simply have this enormously overbuilt system. I mean, when we talk about saving healthcare costs,
mm-hmm.
what does that really mean? That means the healthcare industry is going to get less revenue. And what does that mean? It means somebody is going to have to downsize to some degree.
Mm.
And we're going to get better care out of that downsizing in a lot of parts of the country.
Regina, are you ever going to get this giant, big money industry to downsize voluntarily? Shannon Brownlee says, no, you're going to have to come in and mandate through Medicare, federal government, say, out with some of this equipment, out with some of this overcapacity.
The federal government does not have the political will to do any of this. I've testified in the Congress, for example, on something as seemingly banal and good to do as transparency. Uninsured walk into a hospital, they don't know the price, they get screwed. Uninsured or even insured walk into a hospital, have no idea how many infections people get in that hospital. You'd think that's a piece of cake, but the hospital lobby, now remember, this is nearly a $1 trillion industry. It's usually the second or third largest industry in most states. It has enormous political power. It spends tens of millions on lobbying, and they said, no, people will get confused with this information.
But we're trying to throw off the blinkers. We've got a political choice to make here in the presidential campaign. I mean, if that's what we have to do, if they're not going to come around on a market basis and take these steps, do we have to, as voters, push Washington to say, intervene? Because if you don't, the cost won't come down. We can't fix our problem.
I think Washington not only does not have the will, but it is very worrisome if Washington were to get involved. First of all, decisions in Washington, D.C., surprise, surprise, they're political. For example, the Congress manages end-stage renal disease. This is kidney disease that kills people. It's the only disease paid for by the government. How well is that managed? Well, the costs have inflated, and people get care that is considered deficient. They get too little preventive care, too little diagnostic care. What they get a lot of is a drug called EPO. In fact, they get too much of this drug.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking this hour at one of the real issues beneath the 08 campaign, the cost of American health care. It's huge. Some say out of control, that there's no way to fix the system without addressing what it all costs. I'm joined by Regina Herzlinger. She's professor at Harvard Business School and author of Who Killed Healthcare? Shannon Brownlee's with us from Annapolis, Maryland, author of Overtreated, Why Too Much Medicine is Making Us Sicker and Poorer. The candidates have been talking about healthcare, and they mention costs. Here's Hillary Clinton's new health care ad running in Wisconsin shows Clinton talking with medical workers, and it's got an implied critique of Barack Obama's health care plan.
She fought for universal health care long before it was popular, got health insurance for 6 million kids, and expanded access to health care for the National Guard. Now she's the only candidate for president with a plan to provide health care for every American. A top economist calls Hillary's plan the difference between achieving universal health coverage and falling far short. If you believe health care is America's moral obligation, join her. Tuesday, Hillary Clinton.
I'm Hillary Clinton, and I approve this message.
There's the Clinton word. Obama is out with a new health care ad as well in Wisconsin. It's primary, of course, coming up on Tuesday. He's talking to the camera with images of his mother and himself talking with voters. Let's listen.
My mother died of cancer at 53. In those last painful months, she was more worried about paying her medical bills than getting well. I hear stories like hers every day. For 20 years, Washington's talked about health care reform and reformed nothing. I've got a plan to cut costs and cover everyone. But unless we stop the bickering and the lobbyists, we'll be in the same place 20 years from now. I'm Barack Obama, and I approve this message because to fix health care, we have to fix Washington.
Obama there. He's got a plan to cut health care costs. Senator John McCain is in on it, too. We've got no wide open prairie music behind this. He's just talking, but let's listen. He explains his position from his campaign website.
We need to address the affordability of quality health care where costs are skyrocketing, threatening businesses and families alike. To do this, we need to reduce health care costs. We must reform payment systems to move away from paying for just fragments of care. We should pay providers for care that meets quality standards when treating patients, rather than on a per-service basis.
John McCain with his straight talk style. Well, we've got all kinds of well-meaning approaches here. Listeners, what do you think? Nick is calling from Weston, Massachusetts. Nick, you're on the air.
Hi, I've been studying this for years, and I'm convinced that nothing. Hello?
Yes, we're here, Nick.
I think nothing's going to be done until this actually hits a wall and out of pure dysfunctionality. I don't believe the political will exists in Washington. It's just going to get worse and worse over the next several years, and then what we'll end up with is private for-profit health care for the rich, and finally, after waiting three or more decades, what we've needed all along, which is single-payer, not-for-profit health care for the ordinary American based on outcomes research, which is done in other countries, that decides on the best treatments and leave it at that for the ordinary American who is getting cheated by the present system.
Nick, let's put it to my panel and see what they think. Shannon, is that where we're headed? We're going to hit a wall and then break down into fancy insurance for them that's got and single-payer universal coverage for everybody else?
That's certainly one possibility, but I'm hoping it's not the way things play out, because I think it would be quite devastating for the economy if we wait until healthcare costs are skyrocketing upwards of 20, 25, 30% of GDP, which is what they're predicted to do within the next 20 years. And we wait till there's a total breakdown in the coverage system, which I think is already happening. More and more employers are dropping coverage of their employees.
Regina, you hear what Nick's suggesting, and we heard bits there from McCain, from Obama, from Clinton. Who's on the right path by your lights?
There are two intertwined issues here. One is universal coverage. Should every American be insured? Obama and McCain, they say no. Hillary Clinton says yes. I believe the Clintonian view will prevail. Whether a Democrat or Republican is elected, every American in the United States is going to be insured.
Why do you think that will prevail?
It will prevail because the American people want it to prevail. Health care is among the top issues that American people care about. And as Shannon said, more and more middle-class people are becoming uninsured. The rapid rise in uninsurance among people who earn more than $75,000 a year, those people are in the top 20% of wage earners, is striking evidence of this. Why are they uninsured? Well, you earn $75,000, you take home $38,000. Are you going to pay $15,000 out of that for health insurance in Massachusetts?
Then if it's going to be universal, doesn't that suggest, imply, presuppose a mandate that people have it?
Correct.
But I thought you were all about the market.
It is about the market, but it is very hard for me to wrap around my brain around the economics of health care, and that is health insurance is for the sick. They're 20% of the population.
Well, it's for everybody. Isn't that the whole idea of insurance?
Yes,
everybody has it, so the sick can be covered.
It's primarily needed for sick people. Healthy people don't need health insurance.
But if you look at it that way, it's not insurance. It's just paying for health care.
It is a way of getting the people who are not sick to pay for the sick.
Yeah.
And that's how all insurance works.
Right.
People who are not hit by an automobile pay for those who are hit by an
automobile. And that's good for all of us because we have the peace of mind that comes with
it. Correct. So these 20%, the top 1% of spenders, spend over $35,000 a year with a median family income of $55,000. How the heck are they going to be able to afford health insurance? They will not be able to afford it. And they're sick. They're the ones we want to be insured.
But we'll all be in the pool.
We can either pay for them by all being in the pool, or we pay for them by taxing to pay for the health care needs of the sick. The tax solution will not fly in the United States. The universal coverage, and that is those of us who are healthy, pay for the needs of the sick. That is the one that will fly. The question is not that. The question is, who's going to run it? Is it going to be the government or is it going to be consumers? And these two issues are continually confused and intertwined.
You say government or consumers, but one could say government or industry. I mean,
yes, we now have an industry-based system. We are the only country in the world where businesses pay for so much of health care. And it is clear they're inept buyers. We have highly variable quality of care ranging from fantastic to awful. And we spend 40% more than other countries.
And we have to trust them to do it right and to do it upright. I mean, you know this. You're a director with Healthcare Plans, Inc. They had the FBI in their office, last fall.
But I'm not persuaded that consumers are going to be able to do it all that much better if we basically just sort of throw the whole responsibility onto consumers. Because we're talking about a $2.1 trillion industry, and that's like asking, you know, a school of tuna fish to turn the QE2.
I don't think consumers are
going to be able to have enough information, especially the sickest of the sick, who are the ones who are costing us the most, to be able to be, quote, prudent consumers of health care or even prudent consumers of insurance packages. If employers have been so bad at purchasing health insurance because health insurers don't really make it or what they're providing and whether or not the health care they're paying for is of higher quality, I'm not sure how health consumers, patients, are supposed to be able to make more prudent choices.
There are two countries that have consumer-driven universal coverage. One of them is Switzerland, and the other one is the Netherlands. The Swiss spend 40% less than we do.
And what does it mean that it's consumer-driven universal health care coverage? The doctor sits and outlines the two different treatments, the background on these drugs or this procedure, the percentage of successes and failures.
They buy health insurance.
They buy their own health insurance. And if
to compare health insurance packages,
right.
I have to have some kind of understanding.
Absolutely.
It seems beyond the possible grasp of most ordinary.
It's true. But how do people buy computers? Most people have no idea how a computer works. How do people buy cars? Most people have no idea how cars work. The answer is that people like you, Tom, and Shannon, get in the middle and they take complicated information and they make it accessible to ordinary people so they can be smart about what they're buying.
Shannon, is there any way for that to work? And if there's not, Will American people trust some, I guess what you're suggesting, ultimately a government intermediary to decide for them?
I guess I see two problems with the sort of, you know, throw it onto consumers and let them change the market. The first one is that they're making the choice at the level of insurance, and that's one level above where the choices really need to be made and the comparisons really need to be made. And insurers are not... So we're asking the competition to be at the level of insurers. But where the competition really should be is at the level of providers. And right now, we are not measuring providers in a way that can give anybody, including insurers, the information they need to be able to see who's doing a good job and who isn't.
But that would still be the government doing that measuring and then the apportioning?
Somebody independent has to do that measuring. And that's the key part, is that to get these performance measures out there, it has to be done independently. And right now, much of medical research is not being done independently because it's being paid for by industry. So
pharmaceutical companies and the rest.
Right. So it all needs to be done independently.
I wouldn't say the government is independent. The National Institutes of Health, for 10 years, suppressed funding for one of the most important innovations in cancer. They didn't give Dr. Yehuda Folkman, whose research ultimately enabled Avast and a terribly important cancer drug to emerge, they gave him no money for 10 years because the peer reviewers are sometimes orthodox religionists. And if he doesn't practice their brand of thinking about how cancer should be treated, he's out. So I wouldn't say the government is independent. The government is very political. That's why end-stage renal disease people get so much in the way of drugs. The drug companies lobby the government, and the government can suppress important differences of opinion in a field that is as nascent intellectually as medical research.
But we can't just sit here and go bankrupt. Pete's calling from Narragansett, Rhode Island. Pete, you're on the air.
Hi there. I think the lady who's talking about competitive shopping, if I don't buy a car or if I don't buy a computer, nobody's telling me I'm going to die. You know, so there's that factor right there.
Yeah.
That's what we need.
Insurance is for well people. Insurance is not for sick people. And private insurance requires 25 to 40% markup just for their profit. I mean, that's their overhead. Public health care, which is not insurance, it's public health care, has a 1% overhead. How can private insurance compete with that? It's less expensive for public health care.
Pete, you've got tough numbers there. Regina, what do you say to that?
Those numbers are not correct, but clearly,
still, we know there's a big overhead.
Absolutely. If the government were to do the shopping with its marvelous efficiency, there's no question that its overhead would be lower than many multiple kinds of private insurers. But tell me, why don't we have the government buy our cars and buy our houses? Clearly, that would be much lower cost, too. And the answer is the government, a single payer, suppresses the competition and innovation that is essential for productivity in the economy. You don't hear about a lot of medical innovation in single-payer countries
I'm going to take issue with that.
Please, Shannon.
Everybody thinks that CT scanning, for example, was developed in this country. It was actually developed in Great Britain. Everybody thinks that angioplasty was developed in this country. It was actually developed by a German doctor.
Shannon, let us take those two examples and shove that. We have two and a half minutes, and I want you to look at Obama, Clinton, McCain. Who comes closest to addressing cost, the cost side of this, not just coverage?
I think that they're all trying to address it in different ways. And I think that the Clinton and Obama plans in terms of their cost controls are very, very similar. They're asking for more evidence. They're asking for a different kind of payment system. They're not giving a lot of specifics. The McCain plan...
That means government oversight, government asking for evidence, government deciding what will be covered.
No. It means asking the government to do a certain amount of the research, but not necessarily ask the government deciding what will be covered.
Okay.
The McCain plan has a philosophical difference, which is the belief that the market can solve the problem. And I don't buy that. I don't think that the market is going to be able to solve the problem, because we have a market right now that is failing to have the proper feedback to get high quality and efficiency in this system. And I don't think that releasing the market and releasing consumers is going to solve the problem.
Do you see a solution in this round of campaign debate, or are we still just at the margins of this problem?
We're still talking about universal coverage in this part of the debate. We're still worrying about how we cover everybody, and I think that's an absolutely essential piece of health care reform.
But does that mean a real solution is another 4 or 8 years down the road or more?
Not necessarily. I think that we can do cost and universal coverage at the same time, and in fact, I think it's going to be absolutely essential, because when the uninsured become insured, they're going to use double the amount of health care that they currently use. That's going to drive costs up even more. So we have to do both at the same time.
Regina, we've got just half a minute. Are you willing to bet the country's future on the markets holding the line on costs?
I would bet it on something like Switzerland, which has universal coverage, consumer-driven. People are satisfied with the care, highest satisfaction in the world, and everybody is covered. By the way, the Swiss physician who developed angioplasty had to come to the United States to have it commercialized by an American company called C.R. Bard.
Mm, there's a whack at a huge issue. We'll stay on real issues, see where we can go. Regina Herzlinger of Harvard Business School, author of Who Killed Healthcare, thank you for joining us. And Shannon Bradley, the new book is Overtreated. Shannon, thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.